All right. This is the start of the podcast. We're doing MGO Radio, obviously, remotely because everything is infected and it's terrible. But we'd like to shout out Underground Printing and the Bow Store, despite that, because, of course, they are our title sponsors. Now, Michigan has a game this weekend.
Football? Real football?
October 24th.
October 24th. Season opener against Minnesota. It's a little bit strange. It's a little bit odd. But I've not quite completed the season preview this year because it was a bit crammed. I'll get it up tomorrow, but usually the first segment here is just kind of talking about stuff we've learned in the gap between a previous podcast and this one. And of course, last time we were here, Sammy Faustin had not yet moved a corner.
That's right. I'd kind of forgotten that we hadn't covered that in the podcast format.
In fairness, back to cornerback. You know, he was a corner when he first came here, and then they moved him to safety. And then they moved him back to cornerback.
Yeah, and whenever you have not one but two position switches, especially safety to corner in a fall camp, even though it's extended, that's not a great sign. You have four guys who are in contention to start opposite Vincent Gray. And, you know, you go back and you watch Vincent Gray's film from last year and you remind yourself of how he did. And he was okay for a first-year starter, but he wasn't on the level of a Jordan Lewis. He wasn't on the level of a LeVert Hill or a David Long early in his career. And it's a little worrisome that not only is he the number one, but there's not even a question about it. And also, sort of breaking with, I believe, Don Brown tradition, the plan, at least according to one of the safeties, is to have Vincent Gray follow around Rashad Bateman all evening. So
yeah, there are
some worries, indicators.
They're talking about him like he is a, you know, bona fide number one, like they got Marlon Jackson out there. And, you know, the way they talk about it is like they thought he was Marlon Jackson last year as well. And, I mean, it certainly wasn't what our charting said. PFF loved him and put him in there, but, you know, they're more of a results-based.
PFF had a particular stat, which was completion percentage allowed. And they had a top five of the Big Ten over the past 10 years or something, and they were all Michigan guys. And he finished fifth in that, but he didn't play the same amount that the other guys did, right? So the other guys were like Jordan Lewis and Long and Channing Stribling, who were starters the whole year. Gray got in for maybe a couple hundred snaps, and he was never exactly going up against the opposition's best. So it's a different context for that number.
True, and also we remember certain drops that, you know, were not really him so much as the opposition just dropping the ball.
Yeah. So there was a clear kind of difference between him and Ambry Thomas last year against Notre Dame, where Ambry Thomas got hit by a couple of those Chase Claypool, this is unstoppable, I'm getting it at the apex, and I'm on the sideline and I'm stabbing a foot down.
Which the NFL is now experiencing, so
yes.
We feel very bad about that.
Michigan Chase fans Claypool are not surprised that Chase Claypool is doing things in the league.
No.
But when Gray had similar opportunities, you know, he'd interfere, he wouldn't turn around, or the route would be 3 yards closer to the middle of the field, so he had a lot more room to work with on the outside, Claypool did. So it's so we have questions about Vincent Gray being able to be a full-time starting corner, and like he is far and away the top cornerback Michigan has. And he was just a redshirt freshman last year, so there's a pretty high chance that he's going to improve. But obviously cornerback, probably past defensive tackle, is the biggest worry on this team.
Yeah, I wouldn't be nearly as worried if Ambry Thomas was there and he was, you know, the locked-in number two. But obviously with Thomas out, you've got a situation where it was already a little bit thin at that position. Once you got past the top two, and then you took out the true number one, and it is hard to sugarcoat that Faustin move, especially because the move from safety to corner is not generally the one that works out best athletically. Usually you're taking your less agile or corners who don't have the best top end speed and sliding them back to safety as opposed to the other way around.
Michigan's managed to get their big safeties to be good corners. Like, sometimes you just don't have the ability to, you know, we have Jeremy Clark as, like, our, you know, shining example of that. Brandon Watson, too, they had him at safety for a while, and then they moved him back to cornerback.
He came in, and he was always going to be a press man corner. I feel like Clark is sort of the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Well, Faustin was a guy who played a lot of corner in high school, so he was a corner. He had a couple of athleticism kind of concerns. He wasn't very well scouted, and then he was playing safety here. It's not completely implausible that he could improve a lot, but also last year, you know, the guys behind the starting safeties were walk-ons in the spring game, so he was obviously a long distance away from the field last year. They say he's improved dramatically. It's going to be tough to it's going to be tough to improve enough from being behind a walk-on at safety to being a solid starting corner. It kind of sounds like he's running second behind Jamon Green for that spot.
Yeah, I think most of the worry just comes from the mention that he was the other guy in the mix to start there all of a sudden, so shortly after that position switch.
Yeah. I mean, it might be okay. It's not the hardest thing in the world to envision someone manning a guy up and forcing him to run fades, and these guys are all pretty tall. So, you know, Jamon Green is a guy who athletically is up there. That's what everybody says. And so if he has it click, you know, you could get 4 or 5 games into the season and be like, oh, I guess that wasn't really a problem after all. So there's some chance there that you're going to get surprised to the upside. But
I might be reading too much into a rivals thing, but that's something that was said in an ITF about how their the run defense is really kind of what they've been working on with Jamon. And it's plausible that maybe, you know, he's a decent cover guy, but Michigan's coaches are, you know, if you can't stop the run, you can't play. That kind of, it's not necessarily.
We'll see. I mean
someone's got to play.
Yeah. Right? at least they're being coached by Mike Sordich. We at least have a position coach with a track record here.
Yeah, that's definitely a positive. And the other thing that kind of jumps out when you start looking at the depth Michigan has is they have no one at linebacker who's not a true freshman except for the starters. Inside linebacker, they have an option at Viper. And given that this is probably going to be a year where you see some guys drop out for 3 weeks because they got COVID, there's a very strong chance that Michigan plays a chunk of the season with true freshman at linebacker. Unless they decide to move Barrett over, which might be
the seems to be the plan, that Barrett is basically the backup Will, and whoever, you know, if it's McGrone that goes out, then Ross moves over to Mike.
Yeah.
But that's one guy, and he's already on the field. So
same situation at wide receiver, where you're going to have Saint Russell play inside and out, but really, if you're just looking at guys who are strictly outside receivers, the top backup is a true freshman. And then you get into, like, this guy's a tight end. These are walk-ons. So there's some spots on this roster that are very thin. And the chances that Michigan gets away with it are fairly low.
That's fair to say. I mean, I guess the silver lining is Michigan is very much not alone in that regard, as we're probably going to see with this very first opponent.
It's true. So far, so good, except if that first opponent had someone slip through.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Just don't do the handshakes after the game, guys. Just
don't.
Know.
Yeah. Don't breathe
be sporting
on anybody
this year.
I mean, football, you're going to get close. So the handshakes are not going to really do anything at the end.
I mean, some other stuff to the good that popped out is, you know, you go back over what Ronnie Bell did last year, and I think he's badly underrated because of one particular drop. You look at the depth, you go back 2 years and you see what Chris Evans was doing as an interior runner and his ability to spread the field. And there's that quote from Harbaugh, which is pretty specific about last year. They didn't really have anybody who was a threat on a check down. And now with Evans and Giles Jackson, you have the option to have that guy as your first or second read, especially with a guy like Milton. I think having those guys who you can just check down to and they can get 8 yards is hugely valuable. So that's something that is a positive.
Yeah, and you combine that with some quotes about how Milton has learned to take a little bit off the fastball finally.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy those, though.
We'll see. I mean, we'll find out, because if they're throwing checkdowns and he's keeping it at full velocity, Giles Jackson might get put through the sideline. But
you know, the stereotypical gunner, the guy who could never vary his speed at Michigan, was John Navarre. And he threw a really good screen pass. Like, that was the one thing he could throw other than, like, a line to Jason Avant was, you know, like nice little puffer ball that flies right into Chris Perry's hands. Maybe well, that kind I of quarterback. That,
I mean, you bring up Navarre, and Navarre was huge. And Joe Milton is 6'5", right? So when you're Shea Patterson size, sometimes it's tough to get those screens over the outstretched hands of 6'5", 6'7", defensive ends.
Particularly when you have Shea Patterson's pocket presence.
Well, I mean, we're talking about screen here, right? So, like, I went back, and there's a part in the UFR where in the first game where I'm like, well, they did try to run some screens, but they messed them all up. And then they stopped trying to run the screens. So this might be another place where it's like, all right, maybe Milton can improve on what we had last year there. Just feels like if you have that size, that the arc you have to put on it is so much less that it's a much less difficult throw.
That's true. I mean, there's ways around it. Remember, like, they used to have that throwback screen with Denard, and he's probably the shortest quarterback we've started in
Denard was also able to hold defenders in certain ways.
Right. Like,
you're not going to get that with Joe to that degree, but, like, he is a run threat. And
yeah, he's a run threat, but if we're putting him on the Denard to Navarre scale, he's
closer to That's an unfair scale anyway, because the Denard, you know, there's Denard, and then there's, you know, running quarterbacks, and, you know, Navarre is just an extreme on the other side. And then we cheat. Like, everyone should be a 6 or a 7 and nothing more or less than that.
Well, and Milton does have that ability to keep the ball. The one thing we haven't really seen him do is make decisions. So that was one thing that I was pretty excited about Dylan McCaffrey is I think he's had, you know, a dozen, maybe 24 snaps where he was making his own read. And on every one except maybe one or two, he made the right decision. And Milton, his running has been either just straight up quarterback power or whatever, or it's been a scramble. We haven't really seen him actually run the reads yet. So that's
the reads can't get worse.
Yes, that is an excellent point. It's but it's something where that's going to be something in the first game that it's going to go a long way towards to start determining the outcome, because not only does that affect how many yards you're getting from your quarterback on the ground, but it really changes your ground game.
It's really unfortunate that last year they lost their sort of running quarterback on the first play, or at least got him injured on the first play, and it was a running play, because it's like, you know, these coaches were already averse to having reads in the offense against, you know, anybody except, you know, somebody, you know, except for hard games. Like, this game, no problem. But remember, like, the Army game, I don't know if the reads were even on for that because he was hurt against MTSU. And I don't know if that's going to make these guys shy again in a year when you really cannot afford to lose your quarterback, how much they're going to want to run him this year.
I don't think you really have a choice. I mean, it's not like Joe Milton is going to carry the ball 15 times. Mm-hmm. But you got to keep the opposition honest by giving it to him 5 or 6 times. I mean,
it's also enormous. It's
true.
Joe Milton can take some hits that maybe Dylan McCaffrey was not going to be able to take.
Well, McCaffrey got clocked in the head. So
I was not including the Wisconsin hit. That is, that's an unfair example.
Yeah. And then the other thing is you go back over the UFRs for Gattis and you go back to the RPS numbers, and you have this ugly first half of the season, a lot of minuses, not a whole lot of positives. You get to the Penn State game and Michigan gets even. They get even because they have a bunch of bubble screens. They have some stuff that plays off the bubble screen. And then they give a lot of those points back because their snaps were getting timed up. They fix the snaps. And then after that, he's +6, +1, +17 against Michigan State, +5, +6 to end the year. And then you charted the Alabama game, and you had this, like, I'm not sure if we do this the same, because you had an enormous number. You had like a plus 20, minus 22 for that game. I don't think I've gotten RPS that high. And so there's some charting differences there. But
yeah, I think part of it was you will see things sometimes in the offensive line because you've been doing this since 2007. And I think this is literally my fourth time ever trying it. So like I'm sure there were some things that like I didn't know where it came from. So I was like, oh, this was probably was a good call. There was a whole lot of games that they were playing against each other because pretty much after a couple quarters, Michigan realized that Shea Patterson could not throw downfield. Alabama realized that Shea Patterson could not throw downfield. So Alabama was stacking the box, and then Michigan was doing all sorts of crazy things to keep moving the ball when you have eight men in the box.
Well, so if you go back to the Ohio State game, Michigan has almost 300 yards at halftime in that game. In the Alabama game, they have almost 300 yards in that game as well, and they fall apart in the second half because of that, right?
Yeah.
Because they're so limited in what they can do because they have a quarterback in the bowl game who isn't throwing the ball more than 10 yards downfield accurately. So,
and also isn't making keep reads, so you're limited in two very important aspects.
So sometimes RPS negatives come about because you don't have a full deck of cards when you're calling plays, right? But I go back to the first halves of those games, and I thought those were really, really encouraging from a tactical standpoint because you're doing all these things that are getting you yards on easy reads for your quarterback, easy throws for your quarterback. You're setting him up for success. And Gattis, if Gattis was a player who had that season in his first year as a starter, you'd be talking about him like we talk about Jalen Mayfield, right? Like,
yeah,
a bumpy start, got it clicked in the middle of the season and had an arrow straight up towards the end of the year. So I feel if Michigan gets that version of Josh Gattis for the whole season, the offense is going to just feel a lot better. It's just going to work much, much better than the disjointed, often frustrating offense of 2019.
And I think that's a big reason that I have major Joe Milton-related optimism, too, is that, Gattis kind of came online in the second half of the season, even though there was not a significant change in the quality of the quarterback play. And like we're talking about, he was not really dealing with a full deck of cards in terms of what he could do scheme-wise, play-calling-wise, adjustment-wise because of that. And Milton, he might make mistakes, but he's not going to take aspects of the game off the table. At least not. It doesn't look like that's going to be the case initially.
Yeah, he's definitely going to throw some terrible interceptions.
He's going to put one into a linebacker's chest. Like we could just get that out of the way right now. Like that's going to happen at points this season. But I think you get enough of a benefit from just having a diverse offense that can actually threaten downfield, especially as the game moves more towards you're going to need to score a lot of points. And if you turn the ball over, it's kind of the same as a punt. Especially depending on where you put it. It just feels like the ceiling for this offense is so much higher with Milton, even if it may not click instantly or it may take a year, but even with the turnover elsewhere, it just feels like the offense might be able to maintain what they were doing the second half of last year and even build on that.
Yeah, I just hope that they kind of make it easy to start. I think the teams that have had success building a young quarterback have made the reads really simple at the beginning. Don't ask too much from him. Lean on your running game. Give him some easy passes or some fun passes downfield and just keep him upright. You don't want to have that guy taking a whole bunch of hits in the backfield because that seems to ruin these guys.
Well, they have the personnel to do that now. Jackson came on late in the year. You have Sandra still, who people are really talking
about. We've been getting that right the whole time, and everyone else is getting it wrong. And now it's spread here.
Sandra still. And you've got Roman Wilson, who, if there's a better go target in the conference, we're going to find out. So they have the option of giving him a lot of easy or at least safe throws. And I consider just a bomb down the field a safe throw, right?
Yeah.
If it's either the very worst case scenario is you just had an extremely long punt.
Right. And those punts are going to be even longer with Joe Milton.
Yeah, they're going to be incredible arm punts.
If there's enough of them, we should
third and 10, try to get him to intercept it 70 yards downfield.
Joe Milton for Ray Guy.
Well, could be crazier. And then you've got special teams, which I didn't write up this year, but you have Giles Jackson, who's going to be great. Kind of wish they were using him as a punt returner too, but that looks like it's going to be Ronnie Bell.
I went back and watched all of Ronnie Bell's returns because there weren't that many to go and find them. And if that is your Lloyd Carr safe guy, then he's come a long way. Because there were issues early on. He kind of settled down for Wisconsin, and then DPJ took over again, and Ronnie Bell was not, and like Samer still was the only guy that they used after that. So I mean, I'm sure Ronnie Bell is the old man in the room, but his one good return was against MTSU, and there's like nobody for like 20 yards around him.
Was that what came out of the end zone, right?
Yeah, they're punting from like the one. They're just trying to boot it out as hard as they can. It goes right to him, and there's like
a tiny sample there, though.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. If you remember Peoples Jones, complaining about Peoples Jones and wanting to bench him early in his career.
I'm not saying bench him.
In high school thought was absolutely banana pants for good reason. And, yeah. I mean, it takes guys a little bit to log on, and the other thing to remember is these coaches have seen these guys catch punts so many more times than any of us have. Yeah. And the most important thing is just freaking catch it to start with. And if he's doing that, let's go.
My only thing about the punt returns is Ronnie Bell is pretty much guaranteed to be your leading receiver and is irreplaceable on this roster. So I kind of feel like spread that out as much as possible. Put AJ Henning on whatever it takes. If you have somebody else who's reliable enough, it seems like that would be something that you take off Bell's plate.
But we just talked about how it takes a while for punt returners to like get going. So if they see potential there for a game breaker, then you probably want that a steady game breaker, then you might just have to roll with it.
Yeah.
I
was just going to say, ideally, they get one of those guys kind of worked in and up to speed. Obviously, if they have Ronnie Bell first, then he's, getting to the punts and not making bad decisions now. But I don't think it takes that long to get somebody else in there, and I think that they would be well served to do so.
I do think Bell has upside as a punt returner because a lot of his yardage last year was catch and run stuff. So he had a real knack for grabbing a ball and turning up field, and even though he kind of had a shaky start with slot stuff as a freshman, when it came to get the bubble screens out of the garage against Penn State, they stuck with him. So they obviously think that he's got some real upside there.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things when he was coming in is that he was a bit of an athletic freak show. I mean, the guy had a 40-inch plus vertical reportedly, and that's indicative of some explosiveness.
That's going to be interesting because we haven't really seen him targeted on an arm punt yet because you have Nico Collins on the team. Why would you do that? But now he seems like he's the clear option unless Eric Gall really busts through as like, well, I just need to throw this somewhere. Let's see if Ronnie Bell can go get it. And I think he might actually have some good upside in that department too.
Yeah, well, you can jump like that. And I mean, he's shown pretty good ball skills in terms of being able to track and go after it. Because he had to track some kind of wayward throws last year. So, God, sorry, I'm dumping on Shea Patterson so much.
It's really hard.
It really feels like so much of the context of why the offense is going to be different year comes back to like Shea Patterson just did not have a good senior year.
No, and you're just writing this stuff up and you're like, all right, how can I tone this down a little bit? And it's just difficult. It's very difficult.
He was really good in 2008. I pulled some 2018 video recently, and it's remarkable how much he regressed, which is, I mean, I hope it's just a one-off. I think maybe, hopefully it's just Shea and they didn't really have anyone else to go to, but it's concerning.
The discussion of their off-seasons is markedly different.
Yeah, that's another thing. It seems like they have come to Jesus. Like this off-season, you're hearing about Joe Milton and Ronnie Bell have been working out since April. Cade McNamara popping up and throwing balls to Bell in random fields. That was the literal quote, random fields. Like,
We have to keep these places undisclosed these days for public safety reasons.
Experimental physics symposium. They keep hopping between that and women's studies just because they're sneaky.
But you're going to be like 12 people that got that.
Nobody's using Angel Hall anyway right now.
It's fine. Yeah. I don't need people to get my jokes. I just got to hear them. Anyway, so, you know, you do the whole preview process and you have like a new feeling about the season. And the thing that just jumped out to me is that, man, this is a warm up for 2021. You know, you look at the offense, you got the two deep has a total of four seniors on it. You have a lot of underclassmen. You have a sophomore quarterback. You have a sophomore running back. You have a wide receiver core that's going to get everybody back next year. It's featuring mostly sophomores except for Bell. You're getting three probably offensive linemen back. And then you have that six-man class is going to be in their third year. So there's a good chance you're going to be able to find a couple of very good replacements for the two guys you lose. And then on defense, you hypothetically are getting everybody back except Quiddy Pay. And I'm guessing Hutchinson isn't sticking around.
Yeah, Hutchinson seems like Hutchinson was going to go to the draft if there was no football this year. So I can't imagine after a year of football, unless he like gets injured or tanks, like he's putting some film on, and he's going to put some film out this year. So,
yeah. I mean, the only thing, like maybe he just really wants to do it for Michigan. That's a possibility. His dad, you know, he's a legacy. That would be the only reason I think he comes back, which does happen, but not necessarily super often.
Yeah, Taylor Lewan came back for his senior year. Yeah. That was out of left field.
I mean, Collins is coming back. Amber Thomas is coming back. It does happen. So you lose Hawkins, you lose Kemp, and then you might get everybody else back depending on how well McGrone does, right?
Like, you don't necessarily have to lose Kemp even. Like next year, all the seniors are still eligible.
I hadn't even thought about it like that.
Kemp has been around the program long enough where he might just want to, you know, move on with his life
just get his pension.
Yeah, like,
it's going to be interesting because some of these guys are going to be like Luigi Villain can plausibly get two redshirt years for what he's already had. Then you get a free year for this season. He could be like a sophomore next year.
We are going to have some like epic Big Ten Robbie Hummel just careers going, especially at like Northwestern. We're going to get some dudes sticking around where it's like that man committed in 2004. What are you talking about?
Well, the seniors Antonio don't count Kennard against the camp season next year.
Yes.
Should just let you bring back one guy as a senior who missed a year. Like
X.
Yeah.
Always X.
Oh, man. Always X.
All right. Well, that's, I think, all we have on the team that is new or newish. So let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll discuss
the jug with another guy with a beard. Get a holiday head start with Underground Printing. Whether it's a new custom swag for the staff or personalized face mask for the team, UGP can meet all of your custom apparel needs. They are locally owned and operated and have thousands of 5-star reviews. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide because custom holiday gifts are a great way to stay connected. My wife loves to make fun of me because so many of my shirts are from UGP. They're not all Michigan. I've had them custom make some. They've been supporting MGO Blog for so long that they've had time to replace my entire wardrobe. Seriously, check them out for this holiday. ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go. Let's go.
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team. Yeah.
During these challenging times, it is important to have a Michigan man in your corner. If you or someone in your life has questions, concerns, or just want to discuss your legal rights, give Attorney Jonathan Paul a call at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, michiganlawgrad.com. John asks you all to be safe. We're going to get through this together. And as always, go blue.
Win or lose this season, stop into Information Entropy and make sure that you have a good time on game day. first-time customers can light up a free pre-roll and enjoy the quality cannabis products that this shop has to offer. Located 2 miles away from the Big House and accessible to ages 21 plus, find Information Entropy at 1115 Broadway, across from the Kellogg Eye Center off Plymouth Road. They don't want to hear the words go green over there, but they are happy to help you smoke it. Check them out at Information Entropy.
Welcome back to MGO Radio something point something.
660? Yeah, are we going to 0 or 1? How do you want to count these now?
I have no idea. We start with 0, right?
I think we
start with 0.
Yeah, but they used to be synced up with the podcast, and now the podcast is on like 5. This is a disaster. This is worse than...
I mean, there were years anything else that's happened, and this is not one of them.
We had a 4C this year. What was it? 11.4C.
12.4C. So it's been a disaster.
So this
how's it going, Dooley?
Going great. And I saw that the MGoal blog roundtable kicked back in, and that was exciting to see everyone on that. And now I'm back to talk to you guys about hopefully the jug. I think, right? I mean.
Did you see Craig was in a closet? I like that. He was.
Now is he home or is he in Hawaii? Where's Craig?
He's home. He's in Ann Arbor.
He's home.
Okay. Yeah, you can tell because he doesn't bring his communist baseball shirts when he travels.
Anyway,
we are here with Michigan's foremost jug historian. Is that true? I think that's true.
I would say yes. As far as the history, the deep history and the origins, I'm kind of the guy. I would say that. And I don't know that. Good thing I met my wife before all this. I don't know if that's the coolest thing in the world.
Oh!
I'm the expert of the jug, but I think I feel like I am. I feel like what it is I've kind of cleared up the true origins, some of the myths, and some of the really things I just got wrong. I do take credit for that. Yeah,
like people just had everything completely wrong. Like it's.
Well,
it wasn't even a jug.
Well, it's funny because, you know, it's like, I don't think anybody, if you ask me, people ask me, like, what surprised you the most? It was an important thing. Even in the 20s, like, the jug was considered kind of a deal. Like, it's this historic thing. And that's a long time ago, right? Yet no one had really bothered to really kind of dig in on a few of the things that the athletic department just repeated over and over again over the years. That surprised me a little bit. Now, do I get that no one really wants to take all the effort to go in and study a thing that's not even a real thing to do with football? Of course I get that, right? But that no one, even someone from the Daily or someone like that, didn't ask a few questions about the history, which was really kind of bizarre at the time. Yeah, that surprised me a little bit.
There was a heist.
So, and that's probably one of the big things, right? When I grew up and before I did my research, the athletic department's story was, their line was, the jug disappeared for 4 years between 1930 and 1934 and showed up in a clump of bushes at a gas station in 1934. And that was the accepted history. And I kind of went, wow, that's so. They played these huge games, which I also happen to know, in the 30s. Seth, you know this. And, I mean, these games were for national championships, effectively, right? But the jug wasn't there, and that's the best we got, that it was gone, and then it showed up again 4 years later. And, of course, when I uncovered it, no, it wasn't gone 4 years. It wasn't returned at a gas station in a clump of bushes. There are several stories that were kind of mixed together, mashed together, and screwed up. But no
and
one,
this was
no
like the official line, right? Like they were actually sharing the official line of the jalopy pulling up to where the bear claw is now and throwing the jug at the gas station.
Yeah, and that is a distinct thing that happened in 1931. It has nothing to do with the story of how the jug was returned. And again, these are silly details. You probably got people going, "Wow, Greg Dooley's a kook," but there is something to say for. And here's the problem when you deal with these old stories. First of all, the sports writers took a lot of liberties to enhance the story. They didn't have. There wasn't TV. There wasn't the video. They told a fun story, and they took some liberties with what actually happened in the field. So you can imagine, guys, the liberties they took with something that wasn't even a real part of the game. There's not a statistic behind the jug. You know, the jug didn't score a touchdown. You know, so there were a lot of liberties taken. The problem with that is these stories were told, mashed up, and people kind of just ran with them. And I get that. But I feel like I kind of cleared it up, and there's a bit of an Occam's razor thing with the origins of the whole thing. And I've kind of over all these years kind of wrapped up and really understand the truth, which is in fact an unsexy version of what really, really happened with the jug.
All right. Give us the unsexy version of what really happened.
Okay. People drank water at football games.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
Yep, you got me. Is that unsexy?
Yeah, that's...
So they had a Gatorade jug at the football game.
Including Michigan. They happen to make a lot of jugs in a lot of places, but especially Minnesota. Michigan traveled on a train, needed water, bought a jug, left it at the game because the jug cost 30 cents, Brian. Tickets, by the way, back then were a couple bucks, a buck. So this was not an expensive purchase.
Okay.
They drank the water. They left it in Minnesota. It was a great game, a classic game. Minnesota kept it as a prize, as a memento. Michigan came back in 1909. And they
wrote on it. They wrote stuff on the jug.
They did. They kept it as a memento. Absolutely. That's all true. But, you know, Yost didn't know anything about his jug he left behind. He left it there. He didn't care. No one cared. No, and by the way, Michigan didn't think that Minnesota was going to poison its water. They bought a water jug because why lug one from Ann Arbor when you know they're there? And they left it there. In 1909, they decided to play for it. That's the story.
But how did that come about? Like,
what's Fielding that?
Yost, so it's 1909.
Yes.
And Minnesota comes to Fielding Yost, and they're like, guess what we've got? And Fielding Yost is like, let's do it.
Context here.
That conversation
you forgot
like?
About.
Sure, I'll fill it in.
They're not in the Big Ten at this point. Michigan's not even in the Big Ten in 1909, and Minnesota is, and they're not allowed to play Michigan, right?
Yes, that is definitely part of the story. But the fact is, Minnesota kept this as a memento. The athletic director hung it in his office from this great 6-6 tie from 1903. It sat there until 1909. Michigan came to town. The fact is, the athletic director from Minnesota said, this is a good idea. Why don't we play for it? Yost talked, the captains talked, and they agreed to play for it. That's it. Okay. There was no nasty poison threat. There was no ask from Yost to say, I want my jug back for some strange reason. I want my 30-cent jug that we left in your locker room back. I want it back. You know, there was none of that. And there was no Minnesota going, well, you'll have to win it back in 1903. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Not only is there a complete lack of any evidence for any of that, there is evidence to the contrary that it all just kind of happened before the 1909 game. But you apply some logic to it. But the biggest thing is, Yost left it there. Why would he want it back? And by the way, when were they going to play for it? There was no game in the schedule. How is Minnesota going to give it back to him? There are just a ton of questions, right? So then you go, well, why did all these stories come up? And the fact is, it gets back to what I was talking about before. Well, wait a minute. The media gets a hold of this. Michigan and Minnesota played for this trophy, this prize, this jug. It's weird. It's not a conventional trophy. Tell us some stories about this jug. Oh, yeah. This was Michigan's jug. They wanted it. You know, it was a luck charm for them. We stole it, right? It even says in the jug it was captured.
Yeah.
These are all things that I think people needed, wanted to drum up why it might be interesting that these teams play for it. Media took it. They took control of it. I think they really egged on Coach Williams from Minnesota, Williams Arena, for those of you get, you know, the basketball arena today. I think they egged on some of the players, some of the people around it, and they spun some tails, and it has never really been unwind. Even today, I think the poison the water myth, you'll hear it.
Yeah.
They'll say it. The crazy thing is Keen Fitzpatrick, who was effectively the strength coach back in the day, right, Seth? And yeah. he was the track. He supported the track team, but also Yost teams back in the day on the payroll. But kind of managed a lot of this stuff. He was actually quoted right before the game talking about, does it make sense to bring water to the Minnesota game? They asked him about it in the Daily, credit to the Daily. And he said, you know, we thought about it. We brought water to the game once. And what they were concerned about was more of the Montezuma's revenge, because regional waters had so many differences in our stomachs, because we didn't travel as much. Our stomachs were less accustomed to the water. So you thought, well, maybe we need to bring our water. And he said, he goes, we didn't even bring water to California. And he's talking about the first Rose Bowl in 1902, mm-hmm. January 1st, right? He goes, we didn't bring water and everybody was fine. He never said, this is a few days before the game, he never said, well, we might do it this time because Doc Williams and old Doc Cook from Minnesota, they're going to poison our water, right? I mean, come on. So that story persists today and you'll hear it. And that's fine by me, by the way.
Doesn't sound like it.
No.
Sound a little cheesed off.
Well, I wanted to know the truth. And yeah. And why not, you know, and you guys know the truth. Your listeners now know the truth. People who read my website know the truth. And to me, the truth is just as cool. But also it helped me as a historian kind of unwinding some of these things, but also understanding how some of the misperceptions and misunderstandings and myths happen, and studying that has been kind of an interesting side effect of all this.
So what else did they lie to us about? Do you think World War I happened?
Well, it's World War I definitely happened. Okay. In fact, you know, World
War I,
you can't really unwind wars and viruses and all these things for Michigan football. They're deeply ingrained. Seth could tell you all
the
story.
Do you think tomatoes are real?
I'm not crazy.
I have my suspicions.
Not all Michigan men believe.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about them. There are a lot of myths. There is no crane or steam shovel buried in our Michigan stadium. But you've probably heard that story a million times. There's no evidence of that. You've heard that.
So is that like Yost's fault? Is he just running around saying stuff to people, or did
you know what? I don't know exactly how that happened. Woody never said because I couldn't go for three. There's no evidence.
I refuse to believe that that's not real.
Okay, and by the way, here's another side of this. If someone came to me with that, I would change my mind. I've yet to see that.
That's
Woody
wild.
Thing. Yes, I know.
I mean, I believe that story. I thought it was on the CBS broadcast from that. That was
show me the tape and I'll change my mind.
I did hear that he did not mean to go for two. That like they didn't get the play call, or they didn't get lined up, or something. They didn't get their guys on the field, and
they missed it. By the way, I believe. I think they already had
it. Yeah, they were already up by 50.
Story screwed up. Not a myth, but one of the things that I think is a little bit in question is the one seat in Michigan Stadium, who's it reserved for? Well, I'll ask you guys, who do you think the one seat is reserved for?
Chrysler, yeah.
Okay.
I've heard you talk this before, so I know what you're going to come with this.
So he actually did an interview in Sports Illustrated in the 60s, and they asked him about it, and he wouldn't say it's for me, which, okay, maybe that's in his character. But the backdrop of this story was how much of an important mentor Stagg was. Now, remember, Chrysler is a Chicago guy. He played football for Stagg. Stagg gave him the nickname Fritz Chrysler. Fritz Chrysler is a famous violinist. Ha ha, you're Fritz. You're not Herbert Oren, you're Fritz. Stagg gave him his nickname. He loved the man. If it wasn't for him, I think there's a chance that in his mind – the mythical one seat was for Stagg,
Which would not have gone over great with Yost, I imagine.
Exactly. That would have chapped his ass. So what else? But there's lots of little things like that I think are misunderstood. I'll tell you one thing with the jug, which I'm not sure of. There probably are ways to find out. Is the jug from 1903? Did it survive? Is it the jug that you see on the sidelines? Now, people get confused. There's a Steve Everett, big Steve Everett, who was a classmate of mine, just showed a picture of two jugs in his hands, right? And there's historical photos of multiple jugs and things like that. And then there's the story you guys mentioned earlier where the jug disappeared for a couple of years. Did the jug survive all these years, right? And I did some research on that, and I even pulled in a guy named Ryan Forty from the Henry Ford Museum, who actually is an expert in pottery. And he looked at the jug, he looked at photos, we did all this research. And it's something that I am not sure of. There are people who said the jug was broken at one point, but like, if you go back to all the Michigan equipment managers, I've talked to ones and their lineage goes back to the early 20s, to Henry Hatch and all that. It is, if you ask me, is this the real jug? I would say it's very likely, it's very possible, I should say, that it goes all the way back to 1903. I think it at least dates to the 20s. And I say that because underneath the paint of the current jug, you can actually see the old Minnesota logo that appeared on the jug in the 20s. In 1927, when they beat us in the first year of Michigan Stadium, they actually beat us and got the jug back. We played again in 1929. There's some photos of it. You can see the outline of that pattern on the Minnesota side clearly underneath the paint. So
let me ask you something. So you behind you right now, you have two different jugs. You have a replica of the jug as currently, and then you have kind of the jug that you see in the photos from the Minnesota Athletic Director, and they're different. So how can
now we are a very visual podcast, Brian.
Well, we are. So how can that jug be the same as the current jug? Because they're not.
They painted it. So what they did was the first time, and it's visual, but what they did was when Minnesota got it, and of course it was a 5-gallon jug. This is a small replica. They painted Michigan jug and the date they of the game, and they painted the score. Minnesota 6, Michigan 6 with the 6. The Minnesota 6 is a big, 6. That's not disputed. And we have photos from when they played of a jug when they played in 1910. And then again, now you're getting me, but I want to say 1919. We resumed after Michigan came back into the Big Ten and we were allowed to play Minnesota again. We have a jug. And what they did was they tried to squeeze the scores of the other games on there. And obviously they realized, hey, we want to keep doing this. So they repainted it. So they repainted it in the 20s, and it wasn't until the early 30s until it kind of looked like it does today with the same pattern of block M's. So it actually used to be the first paint job on it was a whitewash with the black letters and the score, and that was how it looked until the 20s. That's when they painted the older style block M Minnesota on it that you can see under the paint today, okay? There are a couple notches on the jug. There's some other things. And by the way, I've done some like layover photos. And listen, if they faked it, okay, if they found a jug that to replace the broken one, allegedly, they did a really good job. Like someone thought, like someone goes, going, Dooley's gonna be on me in 2009. I better have my game together. This better look like the old one, or we're gonna get busted. If they thought all that, they did a really good job of it. So it's absolutely an old jug. And I do, the way Chase Winovich handled it last time, I do worry about it.
I was waiting for his name to come up.
I wish I could have bet on that. I wish I could have bet.
That was the last time the game was played.
It's true.
Do you know the backstory on that? So I did a guest lecture that week. The week before at U of M, Winovich was in the class. We talked about the jug, and I specifically said, because there's a few football players, I specifically said, hold it with two hands and don't just hold it by the handle. Now, this is advice, right, that you've heard before. I don't know. I swear to God, he did it because I said that. I swear to God, he flipped it around and did that because out of like, that guy's watching. That old man's watching. I'm going to show him. I swear.
You know, He's a nice young man. I don't think that's true.
He tweeted at me saying as much.
You can't put Chase in a box, all right?
It will break. It's funny. There have been some close calls, probably more than we know. But John Falk's daughter, when she was little back in the day, was in the equipment room and I guess was jacking around. And it went to the edges of the table and wobbled.
Oh, my God.
But Falk will tell you that one.
Yeah, those two-year-olds, just mayhem.
No doubt. No doubt.
I wonder if anyone can hear mine on the podcast right now, actually.
I cannot.
Yeah, there's screaming coming through over here.
Well, I always find that if you go there and you say, hey, please stop, they do for 4 or 5 seconds. So you just keep doing that. You have any feelings about the upcoming battle for the Brown Jug?
I trust you guys to break this stuff down. It's just been such a weird year. I'll just say, I really don't know what's going to happen. Just watching some of the other games, two thoughts that I feel like this is the time, like, well, what's the value of coaching, right? We look at this. What does a coach really mean? How many points is a good coach worth? I don't know. Certainly in college football seems to matter. To me, it seems like good coaching, good organization, good preparation, good sudden change kind of mindset is going to be helpful. I don't know if that means we have an advantage, but I feel like those are areas where Harbaugh is pretty good in my head. Like, I feel like Harbaugh said, we're going to beat this virus, like way back when, we're going to be the best at this and went after it and is doing everything he can. So I hope that translates. The second thing is how much I miss Big Ten football. Man, you had these big games on, and I just can't get into it. I would rather watch Northwestern and Purdue versus.
We always pick the worst.
No, those are the best. The sicko.
I want some Northwestern football, man.
I just Maryland Northwestern, whatever.
That would be.
I honestly, I'm more into it. I feel like there's more at stake to me to understand these teams because we'll probably play them or we do play them. I have trouble getting into even some of the bigger SEC games, but whatever. I'm glad it's back. I'm glad you guys are back. I'm glad all this stuff's back. So hopefully it'll continue.
Yeah. At least long enough to get the hockey in. That's what you need to do.
Right on. Right on.
All right. Thank you for joining us, Greg. We will see you in the future, I'm sure.
You guys are the best. Talk to you soon. See you.
Thanks, Dewey.
We're going to get to a break.
Thanks, Greg.
On the flip side, we're going to talk about the Gophers.
This is Matt Demrest, the owner of Homeshore Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use Homeshore Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our company. Complicated loan. Brian used them. You should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homeshorelending.com. That's HOMESURE lending.com/mgoblog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me. Kind of an annual tradition. Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
Are you planning a business trip, a Michigan reunion, or a revenge tour in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94? Look no further than the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown. Positioned at the corner of Huron and Ashley, the hotel is just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium and Central Campus with all the amenities you expect. Also, we podcast here most Sunday mornings, so if you let us know you're coming, we'll let you put a shout out on the pod. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages
$110,000.
It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
The University of Michigan was the place we all came together. It's where we pursued our curiosities and where we rallied around things that really mattered. The Alumni Association has now made it possible for you to reconnect with your fellow Wolverines around endless topics within alumni online communities. It's where you can join in the discussion or start your own on any subject from your career, identity, hobbies, or interests. Go to umalumni.com/communities and keep the conversation going.
Get a holiday head start with Underground Printing. Whether it's a new custom swag for the staff or personalized face mask for the team, UGP can meet all of your custom apparel needs. They are locally owned and operated and have thousands of five-star reviews. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide because custom holiday gifts are a great way to stay connected. My wife loves to make fun of me because so many of my shirts are from UGP. They're not all Michigan. I've had them custom make some. They've been supporting MGO Blog for so long that they've had time to replace my entire wardrobe. Seriously, check them out for this holiday. UGP.io/holiday-gift-guide.
Serene is now forever broken. Those around me suffer, but I don't know why. We're on the dole again. Everything I touch turns to cold pixie dust.
Welcome back to MGO Radio 6.0, I guess.
We're doing it. Zero. We're back to zero.
Yeah.
It's going to be a terrible name for podcast nomenclature. Michigan plays the Golden Gophers of Minnesota in a season opener at night in an empty TCF Bank Stadium that will be pretty chilly, I believe. It's going to be 30-ish, and I don't think it's going to be any inclement weather yet, but...
Do you know what is, I'm you know what is warm, Brian?
And I'm seeing Information Entropy Stadium.
Yes, apologies.
We're both hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah, we're trying to nudge Brian in a certain direction here.
Speaking of Information Entropy, we should probably talk about our sponsors, which we forgot to do in the first two segments. Seth?
Oh, I thought you had it pulled up. I have to pull them up. All right. They are. We do know who they are, though. They are Underground Printing is presenting this thing, and we are very thankful to them, especially because they're running the Ann Arbor Institutions thing and providing a lot. This has done wonders so far for all the ones that we've supported. And this week's was Dominic's, which I've been like, I demanded when we put this thing together. I was like, okay, Dominic's is like the first one that I mentioned. Second one I mentioned didn't actually make it in. Anyway, they're them in the Bow Store, Homeshare Lending, Ann Arbor Elder Law, the Residents Inn Ann Arbor Downtown, the University of Michigan Alumni Association, Michigan Law Grad, Human Element, the Phil Klein Insurance Group, and Information Entropy are sponsoring this lovely podcast.
So Minnesota's offense, there's rumors that the entire right side of their offensive line is going to miss that game. That includes Dan Filele, the 400-pound Australian, who's a bit of a fave rave around the blog. But they return Tanner Morgan. They return Ibrahim, I think.
Yeah,
Muhammad Ibrahim. And, of course, they return Rashad Bateman, future NFL first-round pick wide receiver probably. They have a very RPO-focused offense. Michigan doesn't actually let a lot of RPOs go because they run a ton of man coverage. It'll be interesting to see where the push and pull is between Michigan's desired way to play and their personnel, I think is a fair thing to say.
Yeah, and I think we're also going to see that with Minnesota because, I mean, we've got – it's been pretty much confirmed by, you know, their 247 insider that the right side of their line is not going to be playing. I think they both actually battled injuries this offseason, which is one of the might be the driving reason that Filele opts out.
He was out for the bowl game too. He missed Auburn,
so yeah, he had offseason leg surgery.
Yeah,
and then Dunlap, you know, he's a hefty guy. He's 345 pounds. So if you're dinged up on that frame, it might take a little bit to work your way back. So kind of sounds like they'll be missing those guys. And you know, PJ Fleck is also playing very coy about, like, you know, how many starters will be missing because they seem to have a bit of a COVID outbreak on their team. So this was a fun preview to do.
Who are the guys who are supposed to replace the two offensive linemen?
So what? There is one kind of sure thing and then one spot that is up in the air. And that is, so what they're going to do is their projected starting center is going to slide to left guard, and they're going to move John Michael Schmitz, who was a fill-in starter last year for them at center and actually graded out pretty well. Pro Football Focus in their college season preview actually was talking him up as their best offensive lineman. I don't know if I totally believe that since Minnesota's coaches left him on the bench, but he should at least be passable. The other spot is where there's a big question mark at right guard, because what they're going to do is kick their projected starting left guard, Blaze Andrews, who's a utility lineman last year. He's now going to be their right tackle. So right guard becomes both guards are now or center guard of the open spots. And they have two guys, Axel Rushmeyer, which is a very Minnesota lineman name.
Yeah.
And Austin Beyer are the two guys vying for that right guard spot. They both played very sparingly last year. So that's a pretty big question mark. And especially considering this was a team that both likes to run off the tackles and recruited those tackles specifically for the just pounding run blocking aspect, having to reshuffle their line like this, even though they've probably had these guys in place for longer than the rumors have been kicking around since these have been injury related. It's almost certainly a downgrade, especially in terms of their ability to just get push up front. It's hard to replace almost literally 750 pounds of linemen in two people.
Yeah, and that's especially good for Michigan given the questions they have at defensive tackle. So that would be a big boost.
Yeah, no, I think this will be a slightly lighter Minnesota line, a slightly less experienced old man strength Minnesota line, and then that will certainly play into Michigan's hands a little bit.
Yeah, I want to just stay on this for 1 second because their RPO offense is really kind of the basis of everything they do, right? So if they can't win up front, if you can leave your linebacker out from the pass side, because they love to split the sides, right? They do the same stuff Gattis does, where like a whole lot of motion's going one direction, and then boom, they all of a sudden hit you going the opposite direction. And they love to screw with linebackers in those horizontal spaces. If the linebacker can stay put in pass coverage and stay underneath, and they can still hold up on the defensive line, like, that's it. That they got nowhere to go from there. And if they get behind schedule, they're not a team that can sit back and pass block. They are really, and Tanner Morgan is like a very effective passer when he can pass to like the same four spots with the same amount of timing, and they make that happen with their RPO game. So he's very, I mean, I hate using system quarterback because everybody's a system quarterback in 2020. I mean,
he's a system quarterback.
He's a system quarterback, yeah.
He's good at it, but I mean, he's definitely somebody who has benefited a lot from playing in an offense where there's an RPO tag on almost every pass play, it seems like.
Now, there is a caveat. One of those passes that he's very good at is a fly route to Rashad Bateman. So, you know, it'll be who Michigan to leave somebody on top of him. Yeah.
And the good news there is that Minnesota lost Tyler Johnson, who was a fifth round pick in the NFL draft and a really good intermediate guy, somebody who could also go up and get contested catches, and someone who was really good at creating separation in a pretty short period of time. And one of the dings on his replacement, Chris Outman-Bell, is that he is not the swiftest, most agile guy. He is not the best at getting separation. Most of his catches were kind of like, we schemed you open. And, you know, especially when you, first of all, hearing that, considering Michigan's cornerback situation is a little bit helpful. And also, Minnesota funnels an absurd percentage of their passes to their top two receivers normally. They certainly did last year. They really don't throw their tight ends and running backs at all. Their tight end is pretty much exclusively a leak out in the flat guy, so you can't kill their quarterback when he rolls out. Like, so if Michigan, you know, Michigan should be able to roll some safety help over Bateman's way and kind of dare Minnesota to beat them behind not their ideal offensive line with Mo Ibrahim, you know, running off tackle at two very good run defending defensive ends, and hopefully trying to throw the ball to guys who are not Rashad Bateman. I do expect Bateman to still put up some production in this game, but you know, if you can limit that to not disastrous, especially given what Minnesota's working with on the other side of the ball, Michigan should be able to get away with that.
So, I mean, we should talk about Ibrahim a little bit. He's a guy who was a little bit marginalized last year because they had Rodney Smith come back, Shannon Brooks. But, I mean, he looks like that those guys equal, and he's one of the better backs in the league.
Absolutely. I mean, and he's, you know, he kind of gets pigeonholed as a power guy because of, you know, he looks like one who runs through a fair amount of tackles that he plays for Minnesota. But he has enough burst to get to the edge, and he does a nice job of setting up his blocks. He averaged almost 6 yards a carry as a freshman when he was replacing those two backs who have now graduated. And he showed that he can handle a really large workload that year. So even though his snaps were cut back last year, first of all, it wasn't, you know, Roddy Smith and Shannon Brooks were really quality Big Ten running backs in their own right.
Yeah.
So sharing snaps in that backfield is not really a ding on the guy. And it looks like he'll have the vast majority of the snaps in the backfield this year. And he's somebody who, you know, those new linebackers are going to be tested a little bit, and defensive backs in terms of tackling, because he is an absolute load to bring down, and they get him to the edge a lot. So, and that could be an area for concern with, you know, Vincent Gray's your number one corner, drawn in a new second corner, and having a new Viper as well.
It kind of sounds like you feel fairly confident about Michigan's ability to defend these guys.
I do. I just think they're a little predictable, and I do think that losing Tyler Johnson is a pretty significant deal, just in terms of you go from having two legit NFL wide receivers to cover to one, and especially when going against a team that, like Seth said, likes to do a lot of misdirection, likes to pull defenses in two different ways, to not really have that second guy who you have to be truly scared of. You know, unless Altman Bell really breaks out, Michigan can really devote a lot of attention to the guy that I'm most worried can put up points in a hurry and put up points consistently. And I think in general with Don Brown, I'm not as concerned about a Michigan defense getting run over, even with the defensive tackle situation as it is. For all we know, it could even be better than last year's, because last year's defensive tackle situation, frankly, wasn't great. And Minnesota's offensive line is the spot that seems to be hit the hardest by attrition. We're not going to know. They're too deep. I mean, this is the norm with Michigan, but with Minnesota, it's COVID caused. We're not going to know who's taking the field for them until they take the field.
Yeah, and they were going to be stretching. I mean, that was the concern was that they're going to bring back their entire offensive line. They got Mo Ibrahim, who would not look, you know, out of place on Wisconsin's team, right? Like that guy, he can see his holes forming, and he can cut really quickly. And I think that was what I was most nervous about earlier in the preseason when we were going to play these guys, was, oh my God, that line really works well together. They do a good job of exploiting defensive tackles who don't know what they're doing. And that is an issue for Michigan, you know, with Hinton and Jeter out there, even if they've come a long way physically, you know, that kind of offense will throw a lot at you. But if they're also throwing out new guys, and, you know, it takes a lot of the pressure off those defensive tackles.
All right, let's take one more break. Come back. We'll talk about the other side of the ball.
Hey, so I have, like, insurance and stuff, but I don't really, like, know what's going on with it.
Yeah, your coverage probably sucks, and you're paying way too much for it. And I know this because I had a guy, his name's Phil Klein. He's actually a Michigan alum and wrestled for Michigan. He looked at my insurance, and he was like, yeah, your coverage sucks, and you're paying a lot more than you need to for it.
I also, like, I hesitate to even mention this, but I do have my insurance from a company that advertises during college football games. Well, and I wish that was not the case.
Well, why don't you just get it from a cool guy who actually, like, reads MGo Blog?
Well, how would I do that? They have a website?
They have one of those too. It's philklineinsurance.com. Can you remember the name Phil Klein?
Sure.
Can you remember insurance?
Yes.
Okay. Use those two together and you will save money on your insurance and you will actually get better coverage on your home and your auto, and they do life too.
All right. So you're telling me if I Google Phil Klein Insurance, this website will come up?
Yes.
Wonders never cease.
It can be a rough ride along the information superhighway. That's why we build our e-commerce websites tough enough to handle the load. With the capacity to take hundreds of simultaneous online transactions and the stability of load-balanced co-located server architectures, a website from Human Element performs in the roughest conditions. Thousands of products? No problem. We'll throw in the tools to manage them with precision and efficiency. All with a design slick enough to make you think your girlfriend might be impressed. So load it up and hit the gas and let Human Element show you the way. Special offers available for return lessees. Financing available with approved credit to qualified buyers. Client participation may affect savings. Optional equipment available at additional cost. See human-element.com for details.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go. Let's go.
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
Are you planning a business trip, a Michigan reunion, or a revenge tour in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94? Look no further than the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown. Positioned at the corner of Huron and Ashley, the hotel is just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium and Central Campus with all the amenities you expect. Also, we podcast here most Sunday mornings, so if you let us know you're coming, we'll let you put a shout out on the pod. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
Welcome back to MGO Radio 6.0. Before the Minnesota game, we are now talking about the Gophers' defense. Has a couple of players on it, but lost a lot from last year's team, including Antoine Winfield Jr., Carter Coughlin. They had another linebacker, I believe, who was
Thomas Barber.
Yeah. So they're replacing a lot, and this might be a spot where they're losing COVID guys as well. Michigan, well, they may or may not be able to move the ball on this team. Who knows?
I'm pretty optimistic that they're going to be able to, just because even before the rumors of COVID stuff and apparently the projected starter Will, linebacker Braylon Oliver, was injured in spring practice, and PJ Fleck is refusing to talk about it, but it sounds like it might be season ending. So there is almost no expectation that he suits up, and that's going to be a potential problem spot for them. They pretty much turned over everybody who made plays for them last year. Winfield had half of the team's interceptions. If you take Oliver out, they returned 5.5 sacks total from last year's team, and they were not a team that got to the quarterback a lot in general. And another thing that tends to surprise people, given PJ Fleck's reputation, is that they have not recruited particularly well under him. If you go look at the 247 composite talent rankings that only include players that are actually on the roster, they're 13th in the Big Ten in talent. They are just ahead of Rutgers and behind Maryland.
Rutgers recruits okay, but Rutgers recruits much better than Rutgers performs.
Rutgers still doesn't recruit.
Does that include Rutgers being like the an expansion team for Ohio State and Michigan?
It does. Okay. Yes. It includes all players on the roster. Minnesota just has not stacked up these. They don't have the rows of teeth where if you lose Antoine Winfield and Carter Coughlin and Thomas Barber, that you have guys necessarily ready to step in. The one spot where that might be an exception is at that weak side rush end spot with Feldman Freak Boye Mafe.
You had so much fun saying this name this offseason, too.
Yeah, he's, I mean, he's got some pretty astonishing combine numbers. If you believe Minnesota's combine numbers, that includes a 40 and a half inch vertical at 260 pounds and a lot of really impressive weightlifting and running and agility stuff as well. He turned some limited snaps last year into decent production. That said, he also didn't see a lot of time on a defense that really could have used another pass rusher and a decent run defender. So I'm not sure I'm totally buying the, like, this dude is going to come in and be a one-for-one replacement for Carter Coughlin hype. At the same time, he's probably the guy Michigan has to pay the most attention to. They're also... they're pretty openly worried about their nickelback position, and nickel for them is a full-time starter. They only start two linebackers. They lost Chris Williamson, who was pretty solid there, and the competition right now is coming down to a guy who's been a career special teamer and has not looked great when he has been drawn into coverage duty, and then a redshirt freshman who was ranked outside the top 1,000 as a recruit. So that looks like another problem spot in addition to Will. They do have some experience at safety. They keep the starter who was playing opposite Winfield, who was quite good in run support, a little shaky in coverage. And then they have they're hopefully is going to take over coverage guy as a safety is Tyler Newbin, who was their top recruit, I believe, in the 2019 class. He was a top 400 recruit in that class, a very high 3-star. So he's got some talent, especially compared to everybody else they've been recruiting, apparently.
Yeah, but he's replacing Antoine Winfield, right?
Exactly. It's still going to be a downgrade, especially because Winfield didn't just rack up interceptions. He had 3.5 tackles for loss, I believe. 3 of those were sacks.
Oh, and he had a knack for doing it at the best possible time. Like, if it wasn't for that guy's big plays early in the season, last year's Minnesota team has a loss to an FCS team, and I remember you as an FCS team.
Yeah, so, I mean, Winfield was one of the best defenders in the Big Ten, possibly the country. He is already playing right now in the NFL. They're not going to have that same level of playmaker out there. They've lost their best playmakers at all three levels of the defense. They're drawn in kind of some younger guys, some less proven guys, and some guys who weren't really touted as recruits. The one area that really does look like a strength is cornerback. On the outside, they've got Coney Durr, a redshirt senior who was quite solid last year.
Little guy, though.
He is small. He can get picked on by some of the more elite receivers in the Big Ten. The question remains whether Michigan has one of those.
I'm just stopping you from moving on. Let's just stay talking.
The next one, the other starting cornerback is Benjamin St. Juste, the lanky Canadian that Michigan medicaled. They thought his career was over. St. Juste did not, transferred to Minnesota. And apparently, at least so far, St. Juste has very much been proven right. He had 10 pass breakups last year. So did Durr. The kind of one area where these guys come up a little short is they're not big on making plays on the ball that could turn into turnovers. They're more of a batted away type. They combined for one interception last year. And while interceptions are a little fluky, it just seems like both as a team and in general, their technique is more to knock it away than to try to ball hawk, which in this game, could, with Joe Milton making his first start, that could be a big factor. But we'll see. I think Michigan is going to have a decent amount of success both in the run game working against this front, because this is a linebacker group that is totally turned over, looks like it can be pretty pliable, a defensive line that looks like it can be moved around a little bit. They were not good in third and short situations last year. A lot of the quality in their run defense yards per carry wise is because they were really good at putting out fires in the back seven. And they've lost those guys who are putting out those fires, barring one safety. So there should be more opportunities to actually make some bigger plays once you get to the second level. Michigan should be able to get to the second level. And I think they'll also have some success in kind of the short to intermediate passing game just because of who Minnesota has lost. So I think this is actually kind of the ideal defense for Michigan to go up against in Joe Milton's first game, because you've got a team that isn't necessarily going to terrify you with their pass rush. They're replacing a lot. They don't necessarily have the guys that are going to take advantage when you make turnover-worthy plays. And there are just some straight-up questions about their overall team athleticism, in my mind, given the way they've been recruiting. So I think Michigan might be able to get a lot of easy stuff, you know, get it to Sanders, still get it to Jackson. You're not necessarily going to need Milton to keep the ball much in the running game, and you can probably still be productive by just ramming Charbonnet and Haskins down their throats.
All right, that does sound like a nice, like a, other than getting a cupcake to start, that does sound like a pretty good setup for Joe Milton's first start. You know, the guy from Florida being out there in Minnesota in 30 degree weather might be less than ideal.
Any
special teams items of note for Minnesota?
They're kind of in the same situation as Michigan in terms of they have a couple guys who got kicks last year because their initial place kicker got hurt about three quarters of the way through the season. Both of them ended up performing decently well with a pretty significant sample size caveat, since the most that anybody attempted was 11 kicks. But seems like they should have at least one quality kicker out there. And their punter is Australian, so I assume he's good. He's new, but he's Australian. They will have all new return men, so I have no idea what the situation will look like there. They have some pretty speedy guys who were, you know, kind of under the radar recruits that they recruited largely based on what they put on a stopwatch. So, you know, you might have some drama in the return game, but for the most part, this looks like a wash.
All right. Well, predictions?
33-24 Michigan with a lot of running.
That was very close to stealing what I put in the... I had 32-23 in the preview. I wanted to double-check that because, you know, tradition dictates that the score would be weird.
I think I had something ridiculously high scoring on WTK, which I didn't mean to say, and it just kind of came out. But the line has swung. Initially, it was 2.5 to Minnesota, and now it's 2.5 or 3 to Michigan. And I don't know how much that is taking into account the fact that Minnesota is being cagey, but maybe missing a number of starters. So they could be. I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, there have been a lot of points scored so far this year, so it could be kind of chaotic.
Yeah, that's part of my optimism, I think, is that I mentioned that, like, the defenses kind of get leveled out this season because of the lack of preparation, and then it comes down to who's better on offense. And I'm pretty optimistic about Michigan's ability to move the ball, and coaching is also going to be a big factor here. Minnesota's defense last year was the best they've had, and they were still a pretty average Power 5 defense. Don Brown consistently puts his defenses in the top 5 in fancy stats and tends to crush opponents that aren't overwhelmingly talented. And Rashad Bateman is obviously a great talent, but I think when you can kind of focus in on one guy like that, that should help Michigan a fair amount. They've had a lot of time to prepare for this one now. You know, you give Don Brown bowl time level preparation for a week one opponent that runs a relatively simple offense that's probably not going to change, and that changed offensive coordinators as well. A thing we haven't mentioned, but that's probably important. That helps.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. We're going to go away now. Bye.
Thank you for listening to MGo Radio 6.0. Thanks for bearing with us as I try to figure out how to do this over Zoom. Thank you, Underground Printing, for putting us up to this. I also want to thank Greg Dooley for coming out here. Always a pleasure. And Missing Chums, who kindly provided the music today. I have a link to them in the description if you want to find that. Our t-shirt this week is Dominic's. You can find that on the site. And we are going to get it.
out of this!